I thought to myself that perhaps my brother was able to escape from the attackers and that he went to Baghdad since it was so close and since he didn't have any money with which to make the return journey. After first tending to the wounded, I nursed my own wounds and then set out for Baghdad. The robbers took all of my merchandise, leaving me with nothing. All that I had with me were the 1,000 dinars that my brother had entrusted me with, along with a few dinars of my own. To take care of my needs, I spent from my own money until my funds were exhausted. I refused to use my brother's money, for he gave that money to me as a trust. And so, when I wasn't busy searching for my brother, I was busy working in order to earn enough for my upkeep. This continued for an entire year, and still I could find no trace of my brother, and still I kept his money safe with me. Then I became sick and was no longer able to work. It is a little while now that I have been sick, and I have felt for a while now that my sickness is fatal. Having no one to take care of me, I came to this forsaken place to die. When I die, I hope that you will wash my body and bury me. And I want you to take the money and find my brother Mahmoud. If you find him, then give him the money. If you don't, then do with the money as you please. During that night, as Yahya was sleeping, he heard the sick man utter the testimony of faith and then make a croaking sound. Yahya looked at him and knew that he had just died. As no one else was there, Yahya, all by himself, went about the duties of washing his corpse, performing his funeral prayer, and burying him. Also, he took the bag that contained the money. He no longer had any reason to return to his hometown of Al-Dawr. After all, he did promise to search for the man's brother in Baghdad. Also, he had a new supply of funds that he could use, only when necessary, of course, for his upkeep. And so, he returned to Baghdad on the following morning, and on his way, he stopped at the fruit store to pay for the grapes and to reclaim his cloak. He then went to the shores of the Tigris River, where he found a boat that was taking people to the other side of Baghdad for a fee. After he boarded the boat, Yahya found out that he would have to wait about half an hour before it would depart. And so, he began to pass his time by engaging in a conversation with the boat's captain. Finding that the captain's accent was different from that of the inhabitants of Baghdad, Yahya asked him where he was from. He said that he was from Khorasan. Yahya then asked him why he came to Baghdad. But the captain refused to go into the details of his story, saying that it brought back painful memories and that it was no one's business but his own. But Yahya persisted, insisting that he tell him his story. The man then began his story by explaining that he and his brother Ahmed were businessmen from Khorasan, and that they had planned to come to Baghdad in order to buy merchandise. He then went on to give an account of their journey, telling it exactly to the minutest detail as the man who died in the masjid had told it. When he got to the part of the highway robbers attacking the caravan, he said, "Just before we reached Baghdad, a group of highway robbers attacked us and stole all of the goods that were with us. They killed some and injured others. As for my part, I was able to flee from them before they reached me. On the following day, I returned to the scene of the attack, and though I searched hard and long among the corpses and the wounded, I could not find my brother. It seems as if he became overambitious and wanted to keep the 1,000 dinars for himself. I think that he took the money and ran away with it. leaving me to deal with the hardships of poverty. I then came to Baghdad and sat down to rest on the shores of this river. The owner of this boat saw the sad expression on my face and asked me if there was anything that was wrong. After I told him my story, he offered me a job on this boat, telling me that he had become old and weak and could no longer work on it by himself, and that he had no son who could help him. I worked with him, and after a short while passed, he married his daughter to me and gave us a place to stay in his house. Then, a few months ago, he died. May Allah have mercy on him. Yahya then asked him to describe the bag that he had given to his brother. After the man gave a correct and precise description of the bag, Yahya became certain that he had the right man. He took out the bag and gave it to the man, who practically fainted. Yahya sprinkled water onto his face, and when the man came to, he exclaimed, "Where did you get this from?" After Yahya told his story, he said, "Indeed, your brother did not run away with the money. Rather, he was searching for you throughout Baghdad in order to return the money to you." The man said, "Allah's mercy is indeed vast." Yahya then asked him to count the money. And when he saw that a little was missing, Yahya told him that the missing money was used to buy grapes for his brother. The man forgave him for that amount and said, "And here are 10 more dinars for you." Now that he was in Baghdad and had some money with him, Yahya thought to himself, "As long as I am here, why don't I return to the job office and ask them if there is any employment available?" When he arrived there, the clerk said, "Where have you been? We have been searching all over for you, for a position in the ministry has just opened up, and that position is yours." Based on his skills and knowledge, Yahya was constantly being promoted in the ministry until he became treasurer for the ruler of Muqtafa li Amrillah. He also became an official scribe for the ruler. When al-Muqtafa li Amrillah became certain of Yahya's skill, trustworthiness, and sincerity, he appointed him as governor in the year 544 Hijra. Yahya continued to serve in that position throughout the rule of al-Muqtafa li Amrillah and then on into the rule of his son, al-Mustanjid lillah. In fact, Yahya remained governor until he died in the year 560 Hijra. May Allah have mercy on him.
Virtue and integrity.
During the first part of the Abbasi rule, a man from the tribe of Shayban had a very delicate government job. Every morning, it was his duty to patrol the streets of the marketplace until noon, to observe what people said and did, to write down the main doings of the day in a report, to stamp that report, and to then send it to his superior. His superior would gather all of these reports and present the most salient aspects of them to the ruler. This was supposedly done in order to ensure peace and stability in the country. One particular morning, after he finished making his rounds in the marketplace, the man became preoccupied with some other business. And so, after he stamped the report, he called his nephew, whose name was Ahmed, and said, "O Ahmed, do you know where my superior works? The place that I go to every day to submit my reports." The young boy said, "Yes." His uncle said, "Then go with today's report and submit it on my behalf to my superior, and tell him that I became preoccupied with some important and sudden personal business." After he took his uncle's report, the boy began to walk towards the heart of the city, where the office of his uncle's superior was located. Had he followed his uncle's instructions, nothing significant would have happened, and there would not have been any reason for history to remember this story. We only remember it today, 14 centuries later, because the young boy did something wonderful, something that indicated what he was going to be like when he grew up. On the way to the heart of the city, the boy had to pass a bridge that was located over a river. And as he crossed the bridge, he began to say to himself, "O Ahmed, you are indeed young, yet you know what your uncle does. He writes what he hears people say and what he sees people do in the marketplace. What he does is prohibited in Allah's religion, for what he does is a form of spying. And Allah says, 'And spy not.' O Ahmed, you are therefore carrying a forbidden thing and are thus an accomplice in a crime that is prohibited in the Quran." Having come to the said conclusion in his mind, Ahmed immediately held up the report and threw it into the river, after which he returned to his home. Because the report was not received on time at the security headquarters, men were sent to Ahmed's uncle. He told them that he had been busy and that he had sent his nephew to submit the report on his behalf. The boy was summoned, and when he was asked about the report, he straightforwardly said that he had thrown it into the river. The officers who had come were shocked, and they wondered why he would do such a thing. They asked him for his motives, and he said, "Because it," meaning the report and all that it involves, "is forbidden. It is a form of spying, and we have been prohibited from spying, and I don't want to implicate myself in that crime." The officers quickly returned to their headquarters and told their superior everything that had happened and everything that the boy had spoken. When they were finished telling their story, their superior clapped his hands and said, "Such is the integrity of that young boy. But what about us?" From that day forward, people began to treat that young boy as if he were a prominent and well-respected man in society. And do you know who that young boy was? He was Imam Ahmed ibn Hanbal, one of the most distinguished scholars in hadith and Islamic jurisprudence. He was later given the title the Imam of Virtue and Integrity. His virtue and integrity helped serve him later on in life, during the trials of Al-Ma'mun's era. With courage and patience that are still remembered today, Imam Ahmed defended our Islamic creed and endured the frequent torture that was inflicted upon him. Yet throughout, he refused to abandon the beliefs he knew to be true from the Quran and Sunnah. The people who tortured him were quickly forgotten, yet the name and deeds and integrity of Imam Ahmed are still remembered today. From his childhood onward, he refused to compromise his beliefs and actions, which were both based on the Quran and the Sunnah. May Allah have mercy on him.
It runs in the family.
The following story is related about a man who long ago became lost during a journey. In the middle of a wide area in the desert, he unexpectedly came across a house and decided to stop there for help, but mainly for nourishment. When he reached the house, a woman came out, greeted him, and said, "Who are you?" He said, "A guest." She said, "Welcome indeed, our guest. Stay here and be comfortable." She did not lose much time before serving him food and drink. And while he was eating, the man of the house approached and asked, "Who is this?" His wife said, "He is a guest." He said, "Not welcome is he, for what do we have to do with a guest?" Of course, feeling insulted and unwelcome, the lost traveler had to leave. fearing that the miserly host would hold him accountable for the food that he had already eaten. On the following day, he saw another house in the open desert, hungry and forlorn. He decided to test the hospitality of its inhabitants. Again, a woman met him first, and she asked him, "Who are you?" He said, "A guest." She said, "Not welcome as a guest over here, for what do we have to do with a guest?" As she was speaking to him in that uncouth manner, the man of the house approached and asked, "Who is this?" His wife said, "He is a guest." He said, "Welcome indeed, our guest." He then came out with delicious food and served it to his guest. While the traveler was eating and drinking, he mused over the events of the last 2 days and smiled. The host asked, "Why are you smiling?" The traveler told him about the husband and wife that he encountered the day before and expressed his amazement over how opposite the members of the two households were. The host said, "Do not be amazed, for the woman you met yesterday is my sister, and her husband is the brother of my wife. Each has been stamped by the predominant characteristics of his or her family."
A confession.
My story is plain enough. Nothing strikingly poignant about it. But I tell it to you so that perhaps you can learn from my mistake. My marriage began as a very happy union between my husband and me. We weren't rich, but we were contented with what we had, and we had a daughter whom we both loved dearly. In the early stages of our marriage, we would put our daughter to sleep, and we would then pray, glorify Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and recite the Quran. One day, we checked our savings and realized that we had saved a considerable sum of money. And so I suggested to my husband that we should buy interest-bearing shares, the proceeds of which we could definitely use to help our daughter later on in life. We invested all that we had, including the money I made from selling all of my jewelry. After only a short time passed, the prices of the shares plunged. We went bankrupt, and we were left with many debts. We came to learn the hard way that
Allah will destroy usury and will give increase for sadaqat, meaning deeds of charity.
During one of the difficult nights that followed, I got into a huge argument with my husband and demanded that he divorce me. He then screamed out, "You are divorced from me! You are divorced from me!" Both my child and I cried, and through the many tears, it was this that was constantly going through my mind. We were joined together through obedience to Allah, and we then became separated through disobedience to Him.
Let no one issue an Islamic ruling while Imam Malik is in Medina.
The phrase of the title above is one that we hear often when the biography of Imam Malik is being discussed. It indicates his high ranking among the Muslims and his profound knowledge. In the following story, we will see what occasioned the use of that phrase for the first time. It is related that on one occasion, when a woman in Medina died, another woman came to wash her body. The corpse was placed on a table, and the woman began to wash it. Beginning by pouring water over the corpse and rubbing over it with her hand, when she reached the dead woman's private parts, she said, "Frequently had these private parts been engaged in illegal sexual intercourse." After she said that, her hand became stuck to the body of the deceased woman, and as hard as she tried, she could not separate her hand. She quickly closed the door of the room so that no one could see what had happened. But outside, The family of the deceased woman was waiting for her to come out, so that they could then proceed with the funeral preparations. When they got tired of waiting, a woman among them entered and saw what was going on. They all tried to separate the woman's hand, which mysteriously became glued to the body of the deceased. They asked scholars about what should be done. Many among them were bewildered as to what they should do, and others differed among themselves. Should a part of the deceased body be cut so that the woman's hand could be saved? Or should the woman's hand be cut and buried along with the corpse? Finally, everyone said, "Why should we differ among ourselves when among us lives the scholar of Medina, Imam Malik?" When they asked to meet with him, he came to them, and standing behind the door, he asked the afflicted woman, "What did you say about the deceased woman?" She immediately confessed the truth, admitting that she had accused the deceased of having fornicated. The Imam said, "This woman has accused another of fornication, and the punishment for such an accusation, when it is not supported by clear proofs, is 80 whippings." He gave the order, and the woman was then whipped 80 times. After the punishment was meted out, the woman's hand somehow unglued itself from the corpse of the deceased, and the problem became solved. From that time onward, people in Medina would say, "Let no one issue a legal ruling while Malik is in Medina."
The sacrifice that comes with knowledge.
He resorted to promises of rewards and threats of punishment. But nothing Al-Mu'tasim said had any effect whatsoever on making Imam Ahmed rescind his views regarding the noble Quran. After all such verbal attempts failed, Al-Mu'tasim resorted to physically torturing the Imam. Al-Mu'tasim's lackey beat the Imam until blood began to pour down from his back. Then the ruler, Al-Mu'tasim, said, "O Ahmed, say this one phrase and I will free you, and I will bestow upon you many gifts and favors." Patient and steadfast as he was, the Imam said, "Instead, give me one verse or one hadith that supports your view." The ruthless ruler then ordered his guards to inflict more punishment upon Imam Ahmed, which resulted in more bruises and more wounds. A supposedly learned man who was with the ruler then said to Imam Ahmed, "Did not Allah say, 'And do not kill yourselves'?" Imam Ahmed turned to him and said, "Go out and see what is behind the door." The man went out and saw a huge crowd of people gathered outside of the castle, and many of them had papers and pens with them. The man who was deemed a scholar by the ruler called out to the crowd, saying, "What are you all doing over here?" They answered, "We are waiting to hear what Imam Ahmed says so that we can record his words." He returned inside and told Imam Ahmed what he saw and heard outside. Imam Ahmed said, "Shall I lead all of them into misguidance? Nay, I would rather kill myself than lead them into misguidance. Though, of course, it was they who were trying to kill him." Imam Ahmed chose torture and pain over misguiding others. May Allah have mercy on him.
A difficult predicament indeed.
One of our pious predecessors, Thabit ibn Nu'man, was hungry and tired as he was passing through a garden that bordered a river. He was so hungry that he could hear his stomach growling. And so his eyes became fixated on the fruits he saw on the various trees of the garden. In a fit of desperation, He forgot himself and extended his hand to an apple that was within reach. He ate half of it and then drank water from the river. But then he became overcome by guilt. Despite the fact that he had only eaten because of dire need, he said to himself, "Woe unto me! How can I eat someone else's fruits without his permission? I make it binding upon myself to not leave this place until I find the owner of this garden and ask him to forgive me for having eaten one of his apples." After a brief search, he found the owner's house. He knocked on the door, and the owner of the garden came out and asked him what he wanted. Thabit ibn Nu'man said, "I entered your garden that borders the river, and I took this apple and ate half of it. Then I remember that it does not belong to me, and so I ask you now to excuse me for having eaten it and to forgive me for my mistake." The man said, "On one condition only will I forgive you for your mistake." Thabit ibn Nu'man asked, "And what is that condition?" He said, "That you marry my daughter." Thabit said, "I will marry her." The man said, "But heed you this, indeed my daughter is blind, she does not see, mute, she does not speak, deaf, she does not hear." Thabit began to ponder over his situation. A difficult predicament indeed did he find himself to be in now. What should he do? Not get out of it, thought Thabit, for he realized that to be tested by such a woman, to take care of her, and to serve her, are all better than to eat from the foul pus matter of the hellfire as a reward for the apple that he ate. And after all, the days of this world are few and limited. And so he accepted the condition to marry the girl, seeking his reward from Allah, Lord of all that exists. He was nonetheless somewhat anxious in the days prior to the marriage. He thought, "How can I have relations with a woman who neither speaks, nor sees, nor hears?" So miserable did he become that he almost wished for the earth to swallow him up before the appointed date. Yet despite such apprehensions, he placed his complete trust upon Allah and he said, "There is neither might nor power except with Allah. Indeed, to Allah do we belong, and to Him are we returning." On the day of his marriage, he entered upon her and saw her for the first time. She stood up before him and said, "Peace be upon you and the mercy and blessings of Allah." When he saw her grace and beauty, he was reminded of what he would see when he would imagine the fair maidens of paradise. After a brief pause, he said, "What is this? She indeed speaks, hears, and sees." He then told her what her father had said earlier. She said, "My father has spoken the truth. He said I was a mute because I do not speak any forbidden word. And I have never spoken to a man who is not lawful to me. And I am indeed deaf in the sense that I have never sat in a gathering in which there is backbiting, slander, or false and vain speech. And I am blind in the sense that I have never looked upon a man who is not permissible for me." Noble reader, reflect on and learn a lesson from the story of this pious man and this pious woman, and of how Allah brought them together. The fruit of this noble marriage was the birth of a child who grew up to fill the earth with knowledge. Yes, their son was Imam Abu Hanifa and Nu'man. May Allah have mercy on him.